Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
If there is an iconic figure in American politics today, it's John McCain. His career has spanned four decades. His history as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam, well known, and his role as a crusty maverick in the United States Senate, well established. I had a chance to sit down with Senator McCain the other day in Washington for a conversation that also aired on the Axe Files on CNN. Senator, thank you for having us. I don't know if your people mentioned this to you, but I was not. I was on the other side in 2008. I was for the other guy. So it's generous of you to have us, to have me here today. But
I recall that, and could I say that I was honored to speak to your institute as well, which is a wonderful organization.
I appreciate it. The Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. We're going to talk about that because institutions are important right now. But I want to tell you one thing about that campaign back in 2008. The guy I worked for, Senator Obama, when he was considering running, said, and I've written about this, so this is not just for your benefit, said, I think I can win the nomination. I just don't know if I can beat John McCain. And the reason he said that was because he watched you in the Senate. He had watched your campaign in 2000. He knew you were willing to take on silliness in both parties, and he admired you for it. One thing that stood out to me in that campaign, one moment that spoke to that quality of yours, was a moment in Minnesota that you'll remember well, late in the campaign, when it was a town hall meeting and you confronted a number of people, or they confronted you, with their fears about Obama. And you were very, very firm, and you said, I have to tell you, Senator Obama is a decent person and a person you don't have to be scared of as President of the United States. A woman said she didn't trust him, thought he was an alien. You said, no, ma'am, he's a decent family man and citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign's all about. Seems like that moment was more than just a flash in the pan, but a harbinger of things to come, and we've seen it boil over in 2016. What's going on in our politics, and what were you thinking at that moment when all of that happened?
Well, first of all, when that happened and the woman made the statement, I knew Barack Obama. I had worked with him in the Senate. In fact, Ted Kennedy had been sort of the guru for both of us. and I knew he was an honest and decent man. And so it wasn't a planned response. It was just, as it was a town hall meeting environment, that I responded. And as I also said, I had fundamental disagreements with Barack Obama. But this business of destroying people's reputation and integrity, David, honestly, it's not good for America. Let me just give you an example right now. We are talking about, for this United States Supreme Court, about 60 votes being required because that's the rules of the Senate. Now we're talking about breaking those rules. Now, Harry Reid, when he was the Democratic leader, broke those rules. But I was involved 15, 20 years ago in joining together with Democrats to stop that, because that's what makes the Senate unique. Mm-hmm. And so the situation today, as I see it, frankly, there's no group of Democrats that I could sit down with.
Right. No, you mentioned Ted Kennedy before, and I know that you worked closely with Democrats for some time. When you came to the Congress, you had already known and worked with a lot of Democrats because you had been the liaison from from the Navy. But what was it? You were booed in that room that night by your own supporters for what you said.
Yeah.
And your running mate spoke very powerfully to that constituency, and I don't want to malign them. I'm trying to understand, and I'm wondering if you understand, what is driving all of that? What is driving the anger? What is driving the sense of disenchantment out there?
Part of it is that we have not recovered from the meltdown of 2008. My own state
got hit hard.
Got hit very hard because of the importance of housing. You've got these blue-collar, white, middle-aged workers, good, honest citizens who never did anything wrong in their lives that have now found themselves with no economic future. And those were the people that were missed by the pollsters, as we all know, in the last election. So I believe economics had a great deal to do with it. I also think that media, honestly, I mean, let's be frank. There's certain levels of media that are extreme right, extreme left, that you just have different versions of the occurrence of the day. And I think that has had a polarizing effect. But I would say more than anything else, it is the disappointment that so many Americans, the auto worker, that now watches a automobile put together by a robot rather than an individual. You know, it's so.
Well, you mentioned the robots. President Trump ran very much on an anti-trade platform, but it feels like in today's times the real danger for the middle class and for the middle class worker comes not from Mexico or China so much as robots and computers,
which they portray and believe is because of foreign competition. You're right. It has been technology that has caused these jobs to disappear a lot more than trade has. By the way, if I could mention that issue, I've always been very friendly with Hillary Clinton. I've admired her. We've had a very good relationship. We've traveled together. When Hillary Clinton abandoned the TPP, that, in my view, was very harmful for the future because that basically gave the economy of Asia over to China. And in case you missed it in the last couple of days, New Zealand has now made a trade deal with China. China will be going around filling in the vacancy that was created by this America Firsters. And honestly, Dave, anybody who studies history knows the lessons of the Smoot-Hawley tariff acts. I mean, back in the 30s, which led to protectionism, which led over time to, it was not the only factor, but it was a major factor in a global economic collapse.
But it strikes me, Senator, that you're fighting an uphill battle on that today.
Yep.
Hillary Clinton changed her position because she sensed the politics were not with her.
No,
on
I
that.
Understand
Donald
that.
Trump ran that. He rode that tide.
Yeah.
So
I understand that. But Hillary had also stood strong for a long time in favor of it. So when she switched. But you're right. Quote America First. What was the name given to Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford? There's several other names that spring to mind that were the, guess what? America Firsters.
The pro-fascist.
Exactly.
Contention in the 1930s.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, you raised that.
Isolationist.
You were, I was sitting in a stand for CNN watching the inaugural ceremonies, so I didn't see you or your face when the president spoke, but he spoke about America First, and I was thinking, your slogan was country first. Those things mean something entirely different, don't they?
Yes, they do. Country first means do what you can to help your country and your fellow countrymen. America first means whatever you do, America has got to be first in all things. And it the difference between isolationism, frankly, and internationalism is just those one word, country, America.
And which side is winning right now?
I think that the isolationists are probably still winning, but I also think that some of the realities are becoming apparent. For example, in my state, the finance minister of Mexico told me that Mexico does more business with Arizona than it does with Spain. If you cut off that trade cross-border between Arizona and Sonora, Mexico, I'm telling you, you would have a serious and deep recession. There's a couple hundred thousand jobs that are directly, not indirectly, directly related to our trade with Mexico. And by the way, if we continue with this poisoning of the environment between the United States and Mexico, they're going to elect a far-left president. And you think we got problems with Mexico now?
They have an election next year.
Exactly.
Have you communicated this to the president? Have you had discussions with the president about this?
No.
Have you tried to have discussions with the president about it?
No. But I have talked with the people around him. His national security team is the strongest I've seen.
You could have appointed that team.
Absolutely. I would have been honored to have had those
General Mattis, McMaster,
Kelly, Dan Coats, who we all admire and respect as Director of National Intelligence. And I do talk, and Reince Priebus was my chairman in 2008 in Wisconsin. I have conversations with them all the time. The vice president I have conversations with all the time as well. I had two phone calls with the president, and they were relatively brief.
Just getting back to this issue of the climate, when I'm old enough to remember young John McCain coming to the Senate. I was a young reporter at the time. And you were sort of the face of the new conservatism. You were the Reagan Republican, sort of the prime example of that. And you were very close to President Reagan. Talk to me about him and what he represented, because everybody tries to expropriate him now. You hear politicians saying, I'm a Reagan Republican, or I'm in the Reagan tradition. What is the Reagan tradition as you see it, as someone who knew him well?
President was very good to me. He and Nancy were both had a great sentimental streak. And when the prisoners of war came back and he was governor of California, it was amazing the way their hearts went out to us. And so therefore, I spent more time over at the White House than the average freshman congressman and senator. Ronald Reagan was the most inclusive of any conservative that I've ever known. Who was his pal that he used to have drinks with? Tip O'Neill, the liberal Democrat. So they had built a relationship. He would spend a lot of time with Democrats, both senators and congressmen. He's the one that said, if a fella is with me 80% of the time, then I'm with him. When Social Security was about to go bankrupt, that relationship with Tip O'Neill paid off. They both walked out into the Rose Garden and said, we're going to save Social Security, and they had tough medicine that only both of them together could have administered. Was Ronald Reagan partisan? Was he a proud Republican? Was he a conservative of the, in my view, of the most legitimate that I've ever known? But he understood the necessity of us working together. Now, I think it's important to note that Obamacare just collapsed. Why did it collapse? Because there was no
Republican attempt to
repeal and replace it. But back in 2008, the Democrats rammed it through. And so now in 2017, we want to ram it through on a partisan basis. There has been no entitlement ever enacted that wasn't done in a bipartisan basis. And that's what Ronald Reagan did. He stood for what he believed in, but he also believed in relationships. And I probably shouldn't waste your time with this, but one time O'Neill was speaking to the Democrat caucus. Remember, the Democrats were in the majority of the first couple of years, and this one young Democrat stood up and said, why are you always going over and having drinks with Reagan? Why are you going over there with that? And Tip O'Neill said, because I like him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they liked each other.
Yeah. Can we get that back?
Well, you know, Ted was one of the last of those, Ted Kennedy, because it was Bob Dole that said that Ted Kennedy could eviscerate you on the floor. in his speech and then come in the cloakroom and convince you that he wasn't talking about you. But you know the thing about Ted Kennedy? The reason
you guys once menaced each other in the well of the Senate.
We fought and we would fight and we would, and then we would finish the fight and would put armor on each other. I'd never forget. He'd say, "Yeah, we did pretty good, didn't we?" You know, I mean, he was, because he divorced personal relationships and personality from the issues. So therefore, if you were friends with Ted Kennedy, that friendship worked. And it also, like with Reagan and O'Neill, when you had an issue, you could sit down and work it out because you had a personal relationship.
Let me talk to you about your own life. I was looking at a $1 bill the other day, and I said, that guy looks awfully familiar to me, that George Washington. Then I found out you're a second cousin so many times removed from George Washington. Your entire family, every generation, has served in the military. Your father and your grandfather were both four-star admirals. That's an incredible legacy. It's also something of a burden, is it not? I mean, when you were a kid, the moving around, and the burden of just carrying that legacy forward.
Yeah, so typically of me, even to this day, I rebelled. So when I went to the Naval Academy, I tried to break every rule that was in existence.
And they rewarded you by putting you right at the bottom of the class.
The bottom of the class. I didn't break every rule at the Naval Academy, but there's very few that I missed. And I always came very close. I'd get up to the maximum number of demerits, and then I'd behave for a while until the next cycle. But I loved the Naval Academy. The friends that I made
there. You wrote that you knew you belonged there and you dreaded going.
Yes, and I resented, you know, that I had been, ever since I'd been that high, you know, he's going to the Naval Academy. And that carried over into my early days as a devil-may-care Navy pilot. But I made friends. It was a wonderful life. It's some of the happiest times of my life is being in a squadron with 12 airplanes and 16 pilots, and you know, the togetherness and the camaraderie, and that's the same kind of thing that developed with my fellow POWs.
Do you think that part of what's happened here in the Congress is that you don't have people who had served together in war? We had the greatest generation, the Bob Doles of the world and others, who had served together. Was there nothing that sort of brings people together in the way that did?
You know, David, that is absolutely true, because I saw that particularly with Dole and Inouye. There was a bond there. You know, both of them ended up terribly wounded in the same hospital.
Yes, Dan Inouye, late senator from Hawaii, who had lost his arm.
And there was something unspoken there between them. So I do think that mattered some. But by the way, we do have now a generation of senators and House members who were veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's good for the institution.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Senator John McCain. You said something beautiful in your speech in 2008 when you accepted the nomination of your experience as a prisoner of war, which has been well known. But I fell in love with my country when I was a prisoner in someone else's. I loved it not just for the many comforts of life here. I loved it for its decency, for its faith in the wisdom, justice, and goodness of its people. It's a beautiful sentiment, and I think some people would say, my God, you spent 6 years being tortured in solitary confinement, in physically abused in every potential way, and this is the lesson that you drew from it. Why did you come out of that with this extraordinary sense of what America is?
Well, as you just quoted, being deprived of it is obviously one of the factors, but also the bonds that were forged amongst us, even though I was in solitary confinement for 3 years, was in communicating with each other, keeping each other's spirits up, resisting. Don't break and don't make a confession like they were trying to get us to. It made us appreciate, one, love of country, love of our fellow prisoners, and frankly, it was the time of my life that I then gave me a certain quality that I don't think I would have ever acquired, and that is that recognize that if you do the right thing, it's going to be all right. And by the way, I haven't always done the right thing. But when I forgot that lesson, I've always paid a price for it. But I've tried to remember that. And you know, I feel that I'm the most fortunate person you will ever know. When you think of the planes I crashed, when you think of the fire on board of Forrestal one day when my airplane was hit by a missile, 134 brave young sailors died that sunny afternoon in the Tonkin Gulf, and then the shoot down and all that. I mean, I've been so fortunate my
whole
life.
How did that experience inform your kind of worldview, inform the way you look at the world today?
I really believe that that it means that America has to lead, David. I really believe that more than anything. The 20th century was the American century. The early part of it, the two most horrendous wars in history, when you look at encompassing wars, took place. And then America came along and led in a new world order, which is now being under enormous strain.
You also clearly believe that America on human rights needs to take a leadership role, even if it means intervention overseas.
You know, it's a careful balance, but we are the exceptional nation. We are the shining city on a hill. I do travel a great deal. And still the admiration for America. And they want to be like us. They want one of the fundamentals of the United States of America is our belief in human rights. That's how we were founded, to people determine their own future. And sometimes maybe I am too committed to it. Maybe I get too emotional. But when I'm in Mariupol with the president of Ukraine, and a woman is there, and he pins a medal on her. Her son had just been killed the day before by a Russian sniper, and tears flow down her face. I'm guilty. I get emotional, and I don't like
would
Vladimir
you,
Putin.
Would you be so fervent about it had you not had
no.
the experiences you
no.
had? You know, you said something else about your captivity. You said, the thing I missed most was information, free, uncensored, undistorted, abundant information. That seems to be under attack, assault today, too. You kind of referenced it earlier. How big a concern is that?
Huge concern. I think it's one of the major challenges, this disinformation, this some story is somewhere and then gets into the legitimate media stories that are just... Well, look at some of the stories. There was a 60 Minutes piece just Sunday night. One of them was about a guy who just put out all this stuff. Hillary Clinton is dying of, just trash. And all of a sudden it gets picked up, and to the point where a guy believes that there's human trafficking going on in a pizza place in Washington, D.C., and he goes in and fires shots. Really?
Obviously, this is mixed in now with the story about Vladimir Putin. I want to ask you about a friend of yours, Boris Nemtsov, who was killed. Tell me who he was.
Boris Nemtsov was in the Yeltsin presidency. He was a prime minister. He was one of the key individuals. And then, of course, when Putin took over, he was basically the leader of the opposition. And he continued to work in Russia and in the opposition. And he was working on a expose of the corruption in the Putin regime. And he was in my office, and I met him on several occasions. And I said to him, I said, Boris, I don't think you should go back. Twice I told him, I don't think you should go back. He said, I have to go back to my country. It was like a month later that he was murdered in the shadow of the Kremlin. He was a lovely man, and he knew that he was going right into the teeth of danger. And since then, of course, the killings go on by Vladimir Putin. with very little response.
Fair to say you despise Putin, and you've made that very clear. What did you think when you saw the president with Bill O'Reilly, when O'Reilly called Putin a thug and a murderer, and the president said, well, you think we're so innocent?
Killer. What O'Reilly said, it stands out in my memory. He said, he is a killer. And the president said, well, aren't we killers too? That was so appalling to me, to have a moral equivalency between this fellow who is, I don't know how many deaths he's responsible for example, in Chechnya, where he put down any opposition with great killing.
There were several assassinations just last week.
Yeah, one guy was thrown out of a fourth-story window. So to state that there's some moral equivalency between an imperfect nation, that's the United States of America, and Vladimir Putin is appalling.
President, some of his supporters, even he himself, likes to derogate the whole Reagan legacy to him. Do you see him as a Reagan-like figure?
No, I don't. And I think it's pretty clear that there's a difference between, well, aren't we killers, and the guy that stood there and said, Mr. Gorbachev, take down this wall. He spoke out for the captive nations. He spoke out for the people that were behind the Iron Curtain. And after the Iron Curtain fell, there were thousands who said, I heard Ronald Reagan. I listened to the Voice of America. I listened to Radio Free Europe. He gave us hope. That's pretty big difference.
It's now clear, everyone seems to agree, that the Russians did interfere in our election campaign. You said this morning, I think, it's an act of destruction that is certainly more lethal than dropping some bombs.
Because if you destroy democracy, the fundamental of democracy, there are certain fundamentals, rule of law, respect, etc., but one of them is freedom to elect legitimately the leadership. That's the fundamental principle. And if you destroy that, then you have really destroyed democracy. So it's one thing to destroy a building with a bomb or inflict damage, but if you destroy the fundamental of a free and open society, which is what democracy is all about, you inflict incredibly heavier damage.
And the
damage.
Russians are doing that not just here, but elsewhere.
And France, they're playing right now heavily, and they're also going to play in Germany. They tried to overthrow the government of this beautiful little country called Montenegro in a coup, and the pressures they're putting on the Baltic countries are intense.
So if an American citizen were complicit with the Russians in trying to interfere in our elections, would that, in your view, be tantamount to treason?
I think you would have to gauge exactly the circumstances. You know, there's one thing to have a conversation, it's another thing to plot together, but I think it would be something that individual would have to be held accountable.
And obviously you know what I'm referring to because you have ongoing investigations here. Do you have confidence in the Congress to be able to investigate this in an open and clear way with integrity?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has to describe what happened and why and who led him to the conclusion.
Chairman Nunes went down the way. You know, I was thinking about that when that story broke. He went down to the White House on his own, gave the president. And I'm thinking, what number on the Richter scale would John McCain have hit if, as ranking member of a committee, his chairman had done that?
And especially without involving the other party. One of the reasons why on the Armed Services Committee we produce a bill that is signed by the President of the United States every year is because we work in a bipartisan fashion. It's always overwhelming majorities that we pass the legislation out of committee. You've got to work together. And I'm happy to say that from what I can tell, Senator Burr and Senator Warner are working together in the Senate Intelligence Committee.
We're going to take another break, and we'll be back with Senator McCain.
Do you you mentioned earlier the sort of bifurcation of the administration? You have all those people who you have confidence in the national security realm. You've got Steve Bannon, who is sitting at the elbow of the president, who has a wholly different view about the role of America in the world, much more akin to the speech that you heard, the inaugural speech. Who's making the decisions here? Who's has the president's ear on these issues?
I don't know, because I know that the president has great respect for these former military people that he has given the most important national security posts. But on the other hand, I also know that everybody tells me that Mr. Bannon has his ear constantly. So there is a contradiction within this administration. I know that both General Mattis and General McMaster have a worldview of the role of the United States that is very different from what's been articulated by Mr. Bannon.
You just got back from overseas. You're traveling constantly, and I'm sure you're in contact constantly with people from overseas. Mm-hmm. How do you describe American foreign policy right now?
What I try to tell them, and I've been to two conferences in the last few weeks, one in Munich and one in Brussels, is that I have the greatest respect for the team of national security that the president has assembled. And I believe...
What about for the president?
Well, then I also do say, but I'm not sure who the president listens to. But the president has committed to rebuilding the military. And frankly, the last 8 years have been an unmitigated disaster as far as national security is concerned. Look at the world.
Part of that is because of the sequester, right?
Yes, and that was a act of Congress rather than the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. But withdrawal from Iraq, withdrawal from Afghanistan, rules of engagement, there's many other things that were done by the 30-somethings in the National Security Council that I find just unacceptable.
You've worked on some major piece of legislation in your time. One was immigration reform.
Yep.
And another was cap and trade to deal with the issue of climate change. Why did you take those issues on?
I just thought that they needed to be addressed, and they were very important. That's why Ted Kennedy and I sat down together with six others to try to with others to try to do immigration reform. And then there was the Gang of Eight, where I tried to do it again. I believe that we have to have true and legitimate immigration reform, because they're never going to have 11 million people who are in this country illegally without some path, hard, tough path to citizenship. But we also have to have borders that can be enforced and are enforced. Right now there's a flood of manufactured Mexican heroin that's coming into the United States of America that's killing a whole lot of people.
So what's going to happen with immigration? What do you think of the steps the president's taken? I mean, you come from a state with a large Hispanic population.
I think sooner or later we're going to have to address it. And I don't know what this president's going to do, and I don't know what his priorities are. But if he said we have to, quote, build a wall, which I take in the most figurative sense, not literally, build a wall, but at the same time, do immigration reform, e-verify, where you have to have documentation that proves you're in the country legally, where we enforce the border, where we let STEM students, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics students stay in this country, where you provide people a long, hard path to citizenship. Those kinds of things could all be put together in a package, and I would hope the president would consider it.
You know, there was a piece the other day about the precipitous drop in the number of foreign students who are applying to American universities, which struck me as a real blow to our country, not to other countries. What's the impact of that long-term for the country?
You've been to Silicon Valley. You'll see that a significant number of those who are on the cutting edge of the world's technology were not born in the United States of America. I mean, it's just a fact. There's thousands of Chinese students who are studying here in the best schools in America. Why not give them an opportunity to remain here if they have an engineering degree? That's at that end. At the other end is that there is farm labor that American citizens will not do, and we need guest workers. And we could work out a program where people can come and work in the kind of farm labor that is so difficult and return to Mexico or wherever it is, well, return to Mexico after they finish that work. We need to do that.
As we sit here, the president's announced today steps on climate that to roll back much of what the Obama administration has done. What's your level of concern, having worked on this issue before?
I thought that the measures that were enacted, first of all, by regulation, is wrong. The president decided, at least in the last couple of years, if not more, to rule by edict. He said, I've got a pen and I've got a phone. And that was really telling. And a flood of regulations came out. Rolling back some of those regulations has had a positive effect on the stock market. But on the issue of climate change, I think it's happening. And I've been to Svalbard, which is up in the Arctic Circle, and seen the melting of the ice up there. But I also think that we should use nuclear power a lot more. And some of my environmental friends are absolutely opposed to that. Again, it's this polarization that has been so harmful. And could I just point out, in my own state, some of the regulations were just foolishness. They had a Waters of the U.S. regulation for Arizona. In Arizona, we have so little water, the trees chase the dogs. But they put in a Waters of the U.S. Regulation, which affected a farmer who had a mud puddle in his yard.
Pull out of the agreement the president made, President Obama made, the Paris Agreement on climate change?
I don't think I would. I think I would certainly review it to see if there's excessive areas and all that, but I would not announce a pullout. I don't think there's any doubt that a climate change is taking place.
Senator, you know, listening to you, I know that you care deeply about institutions and the institutions of our democracy, and we've talked a little bit about what's happened with attitudes toward the media. We've talked about, our global relationships and so on. There seems to be an assault on institutions. You mentioned the Institute of Politics that I run at the University of Chicago to try and encourage young people to become part of it, but there's a very powerful sort of counter-assault on institutions. You're an institutionalist. You believe in them.
I believe in them. You know, I was on with Chuck Todd the other morning, one Sunday morning, and we were talking about this, and I said, look, I hate you. I hate Meet the Press. But the fact is,
you've been on it quite a bit.
Yeah, without a legitimate, respected media in this country, then you have destroyed the real important part. It's not an accident that it's one part of our Bill of Rights, because you have to have a media to watch what governments do. And you can appoint all the judges and all that, but it's the media that informs the American people. And now with this false media and I'm really very concerned about Americans receiving legitimate, unbiased, objective views on the issues.
Do you, listening to you, there's so much that you are sort of in one place and the president, presumably his supporters, are in another place. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're part of the Trump Republican Party?
I do, because, again, the people around him and I have had long relationships with. I work closely with General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, General McMaster, the National Security Advisor. I've worked very closely with them, and I will continue to do that. And he was elected President of the United States. It's my job to do what I can to get along with the president, but at the same time, I cannot betray my principles and my values and the things that I believe in. So it is a careful line to walk, but I am more worried about this country than I've been in my entire lifetime. We are seeing strains on the world order. We are seeing China. We're seeing 6 million refugees, 400,000 killed. The list goes on and on, you know, of the world, a world in incredible turmoil. It's my job to do what I can to work with the President of the United States.
And do you feel you can move him?
I feel that his advisors can. I know that he has great respect for those that he appointed as his national security team. So I do believe he listens to them.
You know, you started this conversation by talking about your people you'd worked with in the past. Talk to me about someone I know you were close to, Mo Udall.
Oh, yeah.
Who was a liberal icon in the House. And you guys were as thick as thieves.
He was the most entertaining guy I've ever known.
He's the guy who said, by the way, I know you like this. He said the difference between cactuses and caucuses is that on cactuses, the pricks are on the outside.
And that was after he was defeated when he was running for a leadership position in the House of Representatives, and they had this young Turks that were all killed by the old bulls. He also said, by the way, when he came out just before that, he said, I'd like to thank the 120 guys that committed to me and the 60 that voted for me. He was a very funny man and a lovely man, and he took me to raise. We traveled together. We spent time together. He was just... He was everything that I wanted to be, and frankly, I've not lived up to his standard because he was good and kind and generous to everyone.
He was tragically ill at the end of his life with Parkinson's disease. Yeah. I heard that you regularly visited with him toward the end of his life. You'd go over and read the Arizona papers to him.
Yeah, I'd bring the clips and read them to him, and... You know, he just was so lovely and so good to me, and he was kind of, in many ways, a role model to me because of his unfailing good humor and pleasantry. But he was very effective, too, by the way, as chairman of the Interior Committee in the House. He was a very effective member of Congress.
Do you miss that? Do you miss the Congress that you came into? Do you miss the Senate that
you
came into?
Yes, I do. And I miss Bob Dole, who one time when we were doing the Kosovo resolution was given the final speech, and he said, and I've been supporting this by Senator McCain, who for 5 years I wore a bracelet with his name on it. He had never told me. I said, Bob, afterwards, I was watching him on the floor of the Senate. I said, Bob, why didn't you tell me you wore a bracelet with my name on it? He said, Ma, I didn't think it mattered that much. It was a classic Bob Dole. I loved Bob Dole. I loved Howard Baker. I've had the great honor of seeing some real giants on both sides that are really one of the great opportunities that I've had is meeting significantly great leaders on both sides of the aisle.
Do you see them? I mean, this is a kind of loaded question, but do you see them today?
I see a new generation of both members on both sides that I see great talent there. I really do. I see some, especially am favorably inclined towards those who are veterans, who have been to Iraq and Afghanistan, both men and women. Joni Ernst from Iowa, she spent time in Iraq. I see talent coming up. I've great faith in our system of government over time. There's been strains before.
Your grandfather came home from the war, and there was a welcoming home party for him, and he collapsed.
And died.
And he died.
Yep.
And from what I've read, part of it was he didn't quite know what to do.
I know. He didn't know what to do. That was part of it. And also the strain... One of the things that he was also one of these sentimental people. When his pilots didn't come back, he was commander of all the carriers, and when his pilots didn't come back, it was pretty emotional for him, too. It was a pretty big strain on those leaders, you know, because it was a 24/7 filled with tension combat experience.
I ask that in part because... I know your mother's 105.
105.
So I figure you've got maybe four more terms here. But
I don't think so.
Can you imagine yourself not being here? I mean, will you know what to do if you're not in service?
One, I don't know what I will do. But two, David, in all honesty, I don't want to go out on the downside. I want to go out on the upside. I've seen some people here who stayed too long, and you have to.
Senator, I so appreciate your time, and even though we may have different notions on some issues, I appreciate your commitment and great dedication to this country.
What could I just say in return? You've continued in many ways to serve, and the institute that you have fostered, I guarantee you, will pay a lot of dividends in the future, because I had the opportunity of meeting a group of those young people, and they're very talented.
Before we go, Senator, I'd love to see some of the photographs in your office that are meaningful to you.
It'd be my pleasure, David, and despite the fact that you beat me, I will forgive you someday.
I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to that day.
Thanks. Oh, come on in. This is, excuse the debris, but this is the peace signing on the Missouri with my grandfather with his head down. You can see the guy in the front row kind of with his head.
Yes.
That's my grandfather. This is my father, who is Commander-in-Chief in the Pacific, and every Christmas when I was in prison, he would fly to Vietnam, go up to the DMZ, and have Christmas dinner with the Marines. The reason why I love that picture, and I know you'll appreciate this, every one of those kids was draftees. You know, they were draftees. They weren't volunteers.
You didn't talk to your dad. I mean, he couldn't write you. And I know that you were offered the ability to leave, and you didn't because of him.
Yes, indeed. Now, this is this lake in Hanoi that I parachuted into. This is the only statue I've got, okay? It says USAF, which is an insult because I was in the Navy. In Vietnamese, it says, on 26 October 1967, the people shot down and captured the famous air pirate. It says air pirate, Major John McCain. So this one is interesting.
Wait, before you do that, let me ask you something. You then led the movement to normalize relations with Vietnam.
Normalize relations.
Why did you do this?
It was healing. People forget the treatment that Vietnam veterans got when they came home is still a national disgrace. And I thought that it would heal the wounds if we had normal relations. I can't tell you the number of Vietnam veterans that I know that said, I went back to South Vietnam where I was. I went back to Cameron. You know, it was really healing. This statue is next to the lake that I parachuted into, okay? Now, this telegram, real quick, when there was, you remember about 10, 15 years ago, there was this conspiracy thing. We'd left POWs behind, and there was cover-ups and all this, and people, you know, it was a scam.
Yes.
Making money. So they appointed a select committee, me and John Kerry. And one of the allegations of these people who were making the money was that if we declassified documents, that would reveal the plot and the reason why. Well, so we put in a bill declassifying any document, no matter how highly classified, if it had anything to do with POW MIAs, okay? So this is from Averill Harriman, okay? And it's secret, okay? And it's from Paris, okay? And it says here, at the tea break, Le Ducteau, you remember he was the negotiator, mentioned the DRV had intended to release Admiral McCain's son as one of the three pilots freed recently, but he had refused. That was the first, you know, I told him I had refused, but that was the first, you know, corroboration of...
Because you didn't want to be used for propaganda purposes.
No. But more importantly, Ev Alvarez had been there 3 years before I got there.
Mm-hmm. And it was first in, first out.
Yeah. And I knew why they were going to release me. Now, I got to show you one more picture here real quick. About 4 years ago, the Vietnamese defense minister came into my office and gave me this picture that I didn't know existed. That's me being pulled from that lake where you saw the statue next to. Fascinating, and I did not know that existed.
Now, what all was broken? Which limbs were broken?
This arm and both arms, and then when they hit me with a rifle butt once they pulled me out. You can imagine they weren't happy. They broke my shoulder, and also I broke my knee. And
so you probably didn't need the picture to remember the pain, huh?
No, you know, you're kind of in shock, but I remember them pulling me out, and I remember the folks not being very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We just finished bombing the place. And, of course, everybody dislikes Richard Nixon, but I like Richard Nixon because he bombed Hanoi in order to,
he was,
to get us out.
POWs generally were.
Yeah, because he did do the bombing, the B-52 bombing. And it's, you know, he's one of the tragic figures in American history, as you know. So, anyway, so, and that was the day we left also. You can see that I was...
You actually look pretty good there.
Last year and a half, about, they changed the treatment dramatically and would put us in big rooms and with a lot of other people and improved the food and all that. We never quite understood that, but...
Someone told me that most of the others who were released went for meals and drinks, and you asked for newspapers.
Yeah. I was so, and I'd read and read. My eyes would hurt, and I'd fall asleep, and I'd wake up and read and read. And then the Navy was kind enough to send me to the National War College, which was really a great year, so I could really catch up on mm-hmm. everything.
And then you came here.
As the liaison officer, and you know, the two guys that I became very good friends with.
Gary Hart and Bill Cohen.
Exactly.
They were in your wedding.
Exactly.
A Democrat and a Republican.
There you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gary was one of the really intellectual.
He's a great friend of mine.
He's a great guy.
I think it was a great loss to the country.
It was.
He couldn't continue his career.
I think under certain circumstances, he might have been president of the United States.
Oh, I think he was on a trajectory to win that election.
Yeah,
you know, no, it's a tragic story. I talk to him from time to time.
I do too. Yeah. I do too. He's in Denver, and he still writes, and he's very thoughtful.
I think he's one of the smartest guys I've ever met.
He and Cohen were believed on the Armed Services Committee to be the real intellects, you know? And they hung around a lot together.
I covered his race in 1984. And it was really interesting because he had thought the thing through. And one of the parts of his strategy was he was going to go down south and talk about military reform. And he was, you know, here was a guy who ran George McGovern's campaign 12 years earlier. But he had this expertise. And, you know, Sam Nunn was a supporter of his. And he was a very, very interesting politician.
Speaking of Sam Nunn, I saw him the other day at the introduction of, was it Mattis? I've forgotten. He was there at the introduction.
At one of the hearings.
Yeah. That
he was. It might have been Tillerson.
Tillerson, that's right. Tillerson. Yeah, it was Tillerson.
Yeah.
Sam's still probably one of the premier national security guys I've ever known.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you talk about these people because they are very much Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, well... One of the great things about the Armed Services Committee, as you know, is we got this tradition that was established a long time ago, and we stick to it. Small item of trivia, Jack Reed, the West Point graduate, a Naval Academy. First time they ever had the chairman and ranking member as Service Academy graduates.
You got to know Hillary pretty well.
Yes,
on that
very
committee.
Well. Very well. We traveled together. We went to Svalbard together. We did a lot of stuff together. I really enjoyed her company.
And
I really did.
You have a high regard for her?
Oh, sure. Absolutely, I have a high regard for her.
Do you think
her.
She was treated fairly in the election?
I don't know. You know, that I think that the WikiLeaks thing was the most unusual thing I've observed, as you know. But I also, David, you know, whenever you lose, I know this very, very well. You find out all the mistakes you made. When you win, you didn't make any mistakes.
Right. No, I always say you're never as smart as you look when you win, and you're never as dumb as you look when you lose.
Yeah. For example, she came to Arizona twice and didn't go to Michigan. You know.
Right.
Now, if she'd have won, who cares?
Right. Exactly.
But because she lost, then.
Right. And I think there's a lot of serendipity on the other side too, that passes as genius now.
Oh yeah.
It's the nature of the business.
Yep, that's what is it? Berman says that's why they play the game.
Exactly.
Glad to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu. We'll be right back.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.